Hey everyone, I'm Brian Conley of Hunters HD Gold, and you're listening to Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. This podcast takes a deep dive into what it takes to be a match director, manufacturer, sponsored shooter, or just an everyday shooter trying to win his or her first major. So sit back and enjoy this episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Welcome back to another episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Today, I'm sitting down with Darren Snyder. I think I've got that right. Correct?
Yep, absolutely.
Good. And I was, you know, talking to Darren and just out of the blue, and then another friend of mine was there, and I found out that he does little things on a board and puts things together to make people look better, sound better, and in music. Darren, how you doing? Because I had no idea what you did, and it caught me off guard because you've worked with a lot of people throughout your year, and I guess we'll get in that in just a little bit, but let's go back to how we get there, but I don't know yet, but you know, because I've got my thought process, but it's kind of all over the place, but I'm, you know, what got you into shooting to begin with? Is this something you did a long time ago with the family, or is this something?
It's actually not, which is kind of odd. I grew up in Vermont.
Okay, so continue.
Tons of deer hunting and, you know, Maine, that whole thing.
Okay.
Never was into guns. Got into it. I was a paramedic. Got my license when I was 18. I was on a call. Had a bad experience on the call where I ended up blowing my entire lower back out.
So, but a paramedic at 18, that's kind of a young age to seem to do that.
It absolutely was.
Did you do any sports in high school or anything?
I played all-star, Little League baseball.
Okay.
You know, a little bit of soccer. I was into music then.
Okay.
So I was in a normal high school band. We did really well. We were, you know, the popular, you know, band of the kids.
Okay.
And I got into, just by chance, you know, working like as a first responder, that kind of thing. And then I was just like, wow, this feels like it's right. It feels like it was one of those things where, you know, it's like shooting guns. Like you either shoot open, you shoot PCC, you shoot production. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still people shooting revolvers.
Right.
And it's just right for them.
At 18 years old.
Yeah.
Now hear me out, because at 18, maturity levels, majority wise, unless you're a female,
right,
is not where it should be,
right,
at 18 years old. You know, they you know, women mature a lot faster than us.
Sure.
I think I'm still in that category of I'm trying to figure it out. But my point being to you is, what gave you the maturity level at 18 to want to help others? Because that's a pretty big responsibility, right?
I think I was driven. So I started working when I was like 13, 14. So
okay.
I had to get a work permit. My parents allowed me to work, and I was working at a ski outlet. So I was kind of in that retail people thing early on.
Okay.
So I think that really translated into, you know, the opportunity came up. We're doing like first aid stuff, and it was like you do the CPR stuff. And we at that time didn't even have an ambulance service in the town that I lived in. I lived in a small town like just outside of Burlington, Vermont. So I was in Shelburne. So they were like, hey, we're putting together this first response thing. And I'm like, well, I'm not even old enough to drive yet. You know, I was like 15 or 16 or whatever
it's
it was.
It's like volunteer fire department.
Yeah, so it was one of those where it was like, I just kind of went through the process. And then I got, you know, my driver's license and stuff like that. And so I was already, you know, CPR certified. I was EMT, you know, level stuff.
Okay.
And then you couldn't, so Vermont didn't have paramedics, so I had to certify nationally through Maine, but you couldn't do that until you're 18. So I could do all the EMT stuff. I just couldn't move forward into that paramedic thing. So I'm very driven.
Okay.
I still am.
Okay.
I'm very, you know, always want to be in that like top position thing. So I studied real hard, did my thing. I literally tested on, you know, just after my 18th birthday, and I got hired right away. So I was working for a full-time thing up towards the Canadian border up north.
Okay.
So which for us was like a 45-minute drive to work. So it wasn't any big deal, but it was like they had full time. The guy who trained me actually was from Miami-Dade, where one of my teammates, Craig, was a paramedic for the last 30 years. So it was kind of a, you know, kind of a cool, you know, round trip there. But, you know, I went on that call, ended up, you know, blowing out from basically L2 down. So I had to have a bunch of surgery. So I literally went from 19 to 20 to 21, basically, you know, three back surgeries, you know, whole.
Was this from a call?
It was. Like, I ended up.
Was ICE involved?
No. Well, it was kind of cold. So it was a really kind of bad call. And okay. My partner, we ran two people on a pro rig, and back up in Vermont was state police would come in and back us up. But they're 25 minutes, 30 minutes, 40. You just never knew.
Right.
So backup was a ways away. My partner, you know, there was a lot of, you know, blood and stuff. And wow. So she kind of freaked out. I said, just go back to the rig. And I ended up putting him on a backboard and dragging him down a hill. I figure when I went down the hill, all the weight angles, like, you know, dragging, doing the things you're not supposed to bend over and pull heavy weight.
Wow.
And I didn't even feel it.
Right.
Like I still remember it to this day. Didn't feel a thing. Drove home from my shift. We finished our shift at like 8 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. Drove home, was home for about 45 minutes. And I was like, wow, I literally, my leg is like numb. Like I was it was a weird thing. So my dad ended up bringing me to the hospital and, you know, they shot the x-rays and they were like, I had one surgery in December, another surgery in February, and then another one shortly after that. So wow. It was a whole thing.
I guess so.
Yeah.
So what did you do after that?
I was laid up for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, I loved music.
Okay.
It's just like, I didn't want to be in the band. That made sense.
Right.
So, you know, this is pre-internet, just so everybody knows. So there was this magazine called Mix Magazine. And it was just on studio stuff and musicians and that kind of thing. And I was flipping through the back and there was an ad. And I had, you know, they had already told me Workman's Comp, like, they were like, you can go back and do a desk job, but we can't put you back in the field and put you back in the rig. And I was like, right. Well, that's what I love. You know, whether it's the adrenaline, whatever it was like, that was my passion.
Right.
And I was like, well, I love music. And I studied, you know, I literally started playing drums when I was in third grade, studied jazz, orchestral, you know, sight reading stuff. And I thought that was going to be my path. And it was like, you know, you do the band and, you know, obviously in Vermont, we don't crowds or anything else, and it just mm-hmm. felt like that was gonna go nowhere, and that other trajectory kind of took me there. So I was like, man, I love music, but I definitely know I don't want to be a musician. So anyways, that ad, little tiny quarter page ad in the back of a magazine in whatever it was, 1990, and I literally was like, okay, I'm gonna get retrained, have some funding from the back injury Workman's Comp, so moved to Florida. And went to school.
What'd your parents think about you just going from Vermont to Florida?
My parents were always really, I was so independent. I mean, like okay. I said, I was working
since
I was
13.
Like,
right.
I really was not on my own. My parents were always super supportive. Right. You know, my dad used to drive us around in the van, you know, carrying all of our gear. I had nothing. I was married. I mean, my wife my wife at the time, we literally just packed everything up and moved down here. Knew that I was going to go to school for a year.
Yeah.
She was an accountant. So, you know, getting work wasn't a big deal. And it just kind of took off. So school was like TV VCR repair. Then.
Yeah.
Like tech schools were not a thing yet.
That's right.
And so I was just like, I felt like it was good. I went to school, got hired by a private studio, like probably a month or two before I graduated. And we were only getting associate's degrees. And so I graduated, went, and I literally was, it was kind of like I had planned to go to LA. I actually wanted to do sound effects for cartoons. Okay. That was what I wanted. I was right. like, you know, Bugs Bunny, Roadrunner, like that was yeah. like, I thought that was where I was going to go. And my wife at the time was like, wow, we can do anything. And, you know, we came from Vermont where you have like two or three good months and then you have mud seasons and snow and freezing. Right. So right. I was like, yeah, cool. So I ended up opening the phone book, called this private studio. And that day they needed somebody. And so I was like, in, you know, and it was like I had like a month left of school, but I was like, okay, I'll just start, you know, in slowly. About 6 months into that, it was kind of an interesting thing. Got towards the cold time, and Deep Purple, they would work up in Stowe, Vermont, and you know, Perfect Strangers was done, you know, out that area, mm-hmm. and it got too cold. So every day, Deep Purple played soccer. Richie Blackmore, the guitar player, it was like tradition.
Right.
You could be in the middle of cutting a vocal, and everybody would be like, nope, stop, we got to go play soccer. Everybody played, like we had really? Soccer games against Def Leppard. It was like it was the best thing ever.
But Def Leppard, everybody stopped.
It became a thing. So a lot of the like rock bands, they would do like soccer, you know, like just playing against. I remember, this is a little bit further along I remember we were in an indoor soccer thing and watching Vivian Campbell, who's the guitar player for Def Leppard, uh-huh. in the air flying. And I'm like, you got to play a show at the arena tonight. I was like, this is the craziest thing. You know, like the Deep Purple, like Roger Glover, the bass player, they all have wrist guards, you know, so, yeah. you know, they don't mess up. Vivian's just flying. It was the best thing ever. There's some photos somewhere online of the thing. But
that's awesome.
So anyways, Deep Purple came in because it was too cold to be up north. So they come to Florida and they had already done some work at the studio. But they were kind of there to finish some writing sessions and stuff like that. And they didn't like the other guy that was working there. And he's 10 years ahead of me, like literally great experience, great engineer.
Right.
And they're like, hey, can you just kind of set up? Can we just track some ideas down? And I was like, sure. Not a big deal. Right. Real big deal.
Right.
You know, everybody had grown up. I mean, I grew up, I was in high school. Listening to, you know, Machine Head driving around in a Camaro with big tires in the snow. Like,
right.
you know what I mean? It was one of those, like, you know, here these guys are sitting in front of me. So at that point in time, it was a different singer. And then as we started getting some songs down, they're like, oh, by the way, we're going to reform Mark II Deep Purple, which was Ian Gillan. It was the, you know, Smoke on the Water, Highway Star, that version of Deep Purple. And so they're like, well, this is going to be end up being a 25th anniversary record of all this other stuff. And, you know, I started was like, wow, this is getting out of hand for me personally. Like I can work with the band and everybody was cool.
The other guy
was not allowed past the door in the studio.
Based on you taking.
No, it was like they knew they were going to fly somebody in and they're like, can you do this? And I'm like, yeah, if we're just going to, you know, throw some stuff up and, you know, I was thinking we're going to put a couple mics up and do our thing. And then that progresses forward into, oh, by the way, this is going to be a big deal. So it was kind of a crazy thing.
Why did they trust you?
You know, 10 years later, we had that conversation.
Okay.
I was with them for 12 years. And John Lord was a really good friend of mine. And you know, he was like, we don't know exactly what we saw, but we saw that you were there and you were focused. You were in the moment. You weren't worried about us. I think that was one of the things with Purple is that I never, even though they were rock stars to me, I never treated them like that.
Yes.
And I would always say, like, I remember telling Ian, I was like, you suck today, you know? And and he's like, yeah, I do. And he would leave and that was it. And then we were like, now what, you know?
He's going to play soccer.
Yeah. He's going to play soccer. Well, it ended up moving into tennis, but that was a whole nother thing. But, you know, it was one of those where they mentored me, which I still feel like today I'm one of the last people who got mentored by big rock bands, you know? And the experience that they had. So they're a very different band than a lot of bands. Like they've had a revolving door of people like Whitesnake comes out of Purple, like, oh my gosh, you know, Dio, Rainbow. Like there's just so many bands. Like there's actually online, there's a family tree of, you know, offshoot of Deep Purple. And it's just
it's massive. Like the Kevin Bacon thing.
It is. So it was one of those things where it was like, I didn't feel like any of, and I really didn't, I wasn't into the stardom of, oh my gosh, that's Ian Gillan, or oh my gosh, that's, you know, Ritchie Blackmore or whatever.
Right.
So anyways, I told him, I was like, I don't think I'm there yet. You know, and I was pretty honest about that. And they were like, okay, that's cool. So we hired this guy out of New York named Jason Cassaro. Jason died of cancer probably like 8, 9 years ago, whatever. Oh, so Jason was there's a guy named Bob Clearmount, and Jason were at this place in New York called the Power Station. They did Back in the High Life and Springsteen. Jason had done Madonna's Like a Virgin.
Madonna?
But Jason had done the Madonna stuff.
Yeah.
Anyways, you know, he comes in and I was like, whoa, here's the real deal. 4-time Engineer of the Year Grammy winner. Like, he, you know, big, big records. Big reputation. And anyway, so we're making this record. He was with me for like 3 weeks and the phone rang. And it was the guys Chris from Soundgarden. It was, this whole like, hey, we're up at this Bad Animal studio up in Seattle and we're making this record and we want you to come up and record. And I remember the night, like Jason looked at me and he said, oh, this record's yours. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I've never punched vocals on a real singer yet.
Right.
Like, and he's like, I got to go do this record. He loved Soundgarden. He'd already done some previous work with them. So it was like, and I think Jason knew that this was going to be the Soundgarden record. And so he literally was like, it's yours. I'm out. And I looked at Ian Gillan, and I remember, and I said, look, I'm going to erase your vocals. He goes, I know you are. And it was that weird, like, you know, people think celebrities don't, they're like, you know, either the egomaniacs or the machines. And it was like, I felt like, you know what, we're going to get through this as a group. And it was kind of crazy because, you know, for a long period of time, it was, they always looked at me as an equal share thing. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, what do you think? What do you want? How do you, you know? And so for that record, we finished. You, they obviously go out and tour for a year or whatever. And then they're like, hey, we want to come back and we want you to record. And, you know, there was never, I don't think there was producing at that point for me. It was like, literally there was them and myself and a tech, and we literally just made records. We really? Were, we'd be in the studio recording though for a year and a half.
Right.
So, you know, it was full time. Only thing I thought about, eat, sleep and breathe, was, right. was, you know, how to make the best record that I could. And that was great because I had five arguably the best rock musicians to live.
Right.
You know, we're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, career wise, they're at 150,000 or 150 million in sales.
Yeah.
You know, like there's just these astronomical things. They're one of the, you know, everybody's like, you know, Metallica, Lars from Metallica is like, yeah. oh my gosh, Deep Purple is why I am the drummer I am, you right. know? So it was an interesting thing because I never had that stardom with them.
Right. So you knew, when did Black Hole Sun come out by Sound?
So that was literally, so we had finished, I think that was like 91, 90-ish. Right. And I think it was 92, 93,
right.
or 90, probably 93-ish when that Soundgarden.
And you were with them on that?
No, so I wasn't with Soundgarden. I was with Purple then.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so Jason was doing that, which is always funny because we were just recording John Lord's keyboard stuff.
Right.
And so one of the historical things with Purple was back in the 70s, John Lord would have a Leslie cabinet and then he'd have a Marshall cabinet. And the Marshall was just one of Richie's, you know, Marshall cabinets turned up to 11. And we were recording and Jason and I were like, why don't we have a Marshall cabinet? And everybody's like, oh, you know, that was so, we always did that. And so Jason and I stuck one in a closet.
Right.
And we had just finished that distorted Leslie. And then all of a sudden I hear, you know, Black Hole Sun and all, you know, Spoon Man come out. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, that's what we were just doing. You know, so there was this weird correlation between right. the inspiration that Jason as an engineer producer had right. going into that record.
You know, working with different, well, let's first of all, Deep Purple.
Yeah.
But then that's a whole, that's, they're, you know, are they coming, are they in a situation where they're, everything's always, are they always on point? Or are you having to bring them together to keep them organized on something like that?
Because
I can see them being kind of like just all over the place and you having direct traffic. Was that the case? Or
well, I think that's some of why we work so well together.
Okay.
So okay. I always wanted to keep it fluid for them.
Okay.
And so, it was a pretty standard schedule. Like I would literally show up at like, you know, 7, 8 in the morning, you know, Roger Glover, who was my partner in crime forever, mm-hmm. you know, he would show up. He was a bass player and he was really always the producer catalyst, even from Machine Head and stuff. He was the guy who was always running down to the mobile truck to listen. And I heard all the stories because we ended up later on, like mid-90s, we redid Machine Head. Mm-hmm. We remixed it and redid that. And so anyways, Roger would show up. You know, we'd kind of think about, okay, what do we get from yesterday, whatever. So it was a weird thing. Today, everybody records vastly different than we did.
Okay.
They would write as a group. So the first record was kind of like Richie really was driving the ship. Mm-hmm. And then mid that tour, so I guess I should probably go back on that a little bit. So Richie was in Japan, basically walked off stage, right in the middle of the show.
Somebody walked off stage?
Yeah. He walked off the stage.
Right.
And so it was one of those situations.
What during the concert?
Yeah, I think so. It was like right in the middle of it.
Okay.
Well, that was the thing. Like it happened before.
Yeah.
You know, so it was one of those situations where it was like, so anyways, immediately Satriani gets called, you know, because Joe was like, you know, a guy who could pick it up, could do it. So Joe, everybody goes to Japan. Everything is like on point. And Joe, obviously, I've tried many times somewhere in my closets. There is a cassette tape of one of the shows in Japan that, but it was like probably one of the most inspirational times I've heard that band live. And so anyways, Joe couldn't get out of the contract that he was in with the record company. So he couldn't be a member of Purple. And he did a couple of interviews where he's like, oh, you know, it was Richie's. I was like, yeah, I know exactly what went down here. And I don't think, look, I think there was a combination of things, right. You know, coming into a band with, you know, Richie Blackmore as the guitar player was a big deal. Right. So anyways, so we were minus a guitar player, and Roger had seen Steve Morris play in Boston, right. You know, Dixie Dregs. And so, you know, we're like, okay, well, let's just bring Steve in. He lives in Ocala, and, you know, he's a pilot, so he can fly in and out from Ocala to Orlando and all this other stuff. And right. So Steve comes in literally from almost note one. Everybody knew. And Steve just ended up leaving Purple, you know, for some personal reasons. Right. You know, he just needed to, you know, his wife, you know, had some health issues and stuff. Right. And he just felt like he needed to not be on that, right. That trajectory right now. So, but, so Steve and I, so anyways, this next record, they were like, hey, we want to record it. And I was like, okay, cool. I got that. That was like, I can handle the recording. There was no talk of mixing. There was no talk of like what the world's going to hear. I was like, oh, you know, I've got that kind of protection. So anyways, we're recording for 14 months. So meanwhile, we were on RCA. We would do a bunch of like, not necessarily dailies, but you would just kind of be like, oh, here's the direction we're going with the record. Mm-hmm. Here's what's happening. So this went on for a long period of time. So anyways, we got to the end of the recording, which was about 14 months later. And we started to think about, well, what's going to happen with mix? And, you know, Roger and the guys were like, we want you to mix this record. I'm like, you guys are crazy. Like, so in the recording world, there's the assistant, which I never really did with those guys, but there's the recording engineer.
Right.
Then there's the mixing engineer. Then there's like mastering, which is a smaller process. And then, you know, the label gets it and it goes out to the world. So the mix engineer is like what you guys hear as an actual finished product.
Right.
Now, even with those guys, most of, like, I wasn't doing a bunch of trickery like we do today.
Right.
Today, I can cut a guitar and I can put a computer program on it and make it sound like whatever you want. I can make it sound like it's in the Taj Mahal.
Right.
So we were dialing sounds up more accurately to what the record was, which was great because, like I said, I'm probably one of the last generation to come up with a band who played every note, sang every note, mm-hmm. no tuning. Like, it was like we had to get the solos right and edit them and, you know, do all the stuff you guys have seen on TV.
Right.
So anyways, we make this record and they're like, we want you to mix it. And I'm like, you guys are crazy. And, you know, Purple smokes a lot of weed. So I was right. Just like, I was like, you guys really don't like, I've never mixed a big record like that. I was right. Like, this is absolutely insane. So anyways, I said no. And we hired, you know, a couple of guys to mix and they were like the label. Everybody's like, you got to mix this record. And I was like, well, I don't get this, but I did. So I went in for a couple months. I said, it's, you know, it's going to take me, you know, some time to get it going and stuff. And I actually recently just listened, right? The record is called Perpendicular. And I went back and listened to it. And then, you know, I'm 30 years into my career now. So I'm looking back going, man, this is going to be rough. And I was like, man, I wouldn't change a thing. I put everything I had, you know, creatively, mentally into that record. And it really was that situation where it was like, I was like, there's nothing else I would have left on the table with it.
And all that just came through by you kind of a self-teaching kind of thing.
Then, yeah, right? It was self-teaching.
Right.
But I had five of the best mentors. Like, wow. Like it never felt like they were asking me to do something I couldn't. They were never pushing the, oh, we need to do it this way and we need to be on the schedule. Like, we never really had that pressure.
Right.
Like, because there was no time. There was like, when we get done with this record, we get done with when we get done with the song. Right. So that went on, mixed that record. That was great for us. You know, in total, it was like 12 years. We did like 14 records.
Wow. You see, know? This explains so much more to me because the Beatles, for an example, just released something. So there's all these recordings.
Oh my gosh, tons.
From that, you know, they could be doing this another 100 years, I guess, because there's so much stuff based on what you're telling me that's behind the scenes that never makes.
So normally, the cut, right? So it's kind of a weird thing. So Deep Purple, because of who they are and what they are, and they had done so many great records before. So for a song that you would get 10 or 12 songs for, mm-hmm. we would do 14 or 16. A pop record, like, so fast forwarding in the mid 90s, I did Backstreet Boys. So quit playing games with your heart.
You did Backstreet Boys.
I did Backstreet Boys. So, and I think we'll back up a little bit to the Orlando thing. So what happened was
Purple. My mind is just shot right now. I'm all over the place.
Oh, it gets worse. So Deep Purple was like my world.
Okay.
But Central Florida was a weird place because a lot of the old 80s, let's say 70s, 80s rock bands,
okay.
a lot of people lived here in Florida. So what was crazy about that was Molly Hatchet was in the studio next to us.
Okay.
38 Special was around.
So you saw these people regularly.
Oh my gosh, we did like the Buzzcocks, Yellow Jackets, yeah. like some cool, you know, things. So there was a lot of that rock band thing.
Right.
But what was bubbling, which we didn't know. So I finished Perpendicular, let's just call it in that 94-ish, 95. And, you know, that was the start of what we didn't know at that point. We were just guys who wanted to make records. There was literally like three studios in Orlando.
Right.
And it was like, you had to go to one of the three of us. But we had, you know, Seven Mary Three, which Cumbersome was a number one for us in like 95. Matchbox 20, which was actually Tabitha Secret at that time. We had Collective Soul, who broke out of here. And we had then, you know, Lou Pearlman. Everybody can watch the documentaries, but Lou's like, hey, I got these 13, 14-year-old kids. You want to make a record? And we were all like, you know, he was paying great money, which we now know was not his money, but he was paying great money.
He got these five kids.
Yeah. And well, look.
So you got to hear them before.
Oh, we were literally, I was, you know, once they did one test record before us. So I was on the very first Quit Playing Games With Your Heart, the first big single that broke with them. So the crazy thing was Menudo had already happened. Boys to Men was kind of on their way out. So the boy band thing wasn't as, so we were doing it. We were like, look, we'll just cash check, move on. I remember finishing a mix. The producer was asleep on the couch. It was like 9 a.m. I'd finished the mix, put it on his chest, walked out the door. And I was like, I will never, ever hear from this again. And, you know, then we now know what happened. So then outside of that, then we, you know, Britney starts coming up.
Yeah.
You know, so we all start tracking with Britney. I didn't do NSYNC. One of my friends.
But you saw Britney Spears?
Oh, I did Britney when she was like, Hit Me Baby One More Time. I was recording that stuff.
You were there behind the scenes recording all that.
I was
mixing, recording.
And this is a kind of a weird thing. The first night Britney went on stage as Britney Spears, the artist, was at Tupperware Auditorium downtown Orlando.
Right.
And I'll never forget, like a silver sequin jumpsuit. And she only got like, the curtain came out because NSYNC was, she was opening for NSYNC.
Okay.
And the curtain came out and she had like 5 feet of stage,
right?
You know, doing her, that first record before it blew up. But.
So you got, golly.
I know it goes all over the place because Orlando went all over the place.
Yeah.
We had like Starship and then the next day you're with a pop act. Like Christina came out. None of us, Christina was probably brought to LA more than like, but she came out of Mouse Club.
So when you saw Britney, this is back in the day when
she was 13, 14.
Everybody was in control.
Yeah, 14.
She was still. So did you have any idea when you see the Backstreet Boys and you see these people with talent, did you have any idea that we'd be talking still about them 30 years ago, 40 years ago now?
Not a chance.
I mean, yeah, that's not what I'm saying. Chance. That's a weird thing.
So a lot of my close friends, like, so one of the guys that went to school, same time, we didn't even really know each other. He goes to Atlanta this exact same time and he blows up with this guy named Jermaine Dupri, which was, he did the Madonna record. He did, you know, let's see, TLC, like Waterfalls, all that stuff. He was doing all that. So it was like this East Coast thing was happening, but we didn't know it. Like we were just, again, everybody was just so into, let's just make music. I got a studio. You got a band.
Is there managers all around you having to deal with? What are you having to
do? Yeah, label. Well, so we were all
record,
tons of record labels.
Okay.
Local. There was a couple of the guys that did the Miami Bay stuff had these, and the money was insane because at that point in time, we were selling records. So, like, so example, Backstreet Boys, the first record domestically right now, it's, there's like, I think less than 100, what we call diamond records, which it's 10 million units in the US alone. We're at like 14 with that one.
Like
the
first, diamond?
No, 14 million in the US alone.
Though. Okay.
So worldwide, that turns into probably 30 million you know, units worldwide. But you got to figure each one of those records was selling for $15, $16.
Right.
And you do the math out on this, it's just astronomical money.
See, a lot of people aren't aware of what goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And TV shows like American Idol. Bring some of these producers to the forefront. So you start seeing producers, you start seeing more stuff. You're basically doing the same thing, walking them through different things like that we see on TV.
Kind of. Yeah.
But before TV, of course. But before.
My big chunk of my career was a recording engineer and mix engineer. So basically the recording is you go in the studio, record vocals. The mix engineer is the one who's doing all the little fine tweaking of, you know, like EQ or putting them in a certain room in a reverb.
Right.
So we are the polishing, if you will.
You know?
The rough diamond cut is hit and then we're in there polishing that up. So producing is that weird thing because with Purple, we were all creatively, you know, I wasn't out there playing guitar, that's but right. I was like, you know, that part's not working or we should redo that. Or, right. you know, you just get into that weird grind. I didn't know I was producing. I didn't know I was learning how to be a producer.
Okay.
And so as things progressed forward, you know, I got to that weird point where it was like mixing was my passion. It still mm-hmm. is. Like my career is probably 60, 70% mixing and then producing and then engineering now. But the word producer is now a slang word. So Quincy Jones, those guys, you yeah. would be so in the trenches of song arrangement,
right.
Parts, performance, you know, going, hey, that felt good. It didn't right. feel good. Or even just picking the right studio to make sure that they felt like they could.
Because right. sometimes, you know, I remember when a bunch of stuff with music was going on and then all of a sudden there's this thing called Napster and everything was getting music for free. And internet was really just kind of getting started. And were you a part of this whole movement when music started to get, you know, just downloaded for free and nobody getting credit? You know, I think Lars was in charge of that.
So Lars was a big, he was a big one. He was a big push on that.
Was this a thing that you had to deal with yourself?
So no, and I'll tell you why, because when we left vinyl as a musical culture, 8-tracks could be duplicated, but cassette is what really changed the world okay. for music. Okay. So there's always been, since cassette, there's been piracy, tons mm-hmm. of it. From my perspective, what I saw being in the 90s is just unbelievable amounts of money. Okay. Like insane amounts. Yeah. Like people, mix engineers could get, you know, $5,000 a day and you're like, you know what? I don't feel like getting up this morning. Like there was that much work at wow. that kind of numbers.
Wow.
And, you know, you're not even the person anybody knows. And there was that kind of money.
Wow.
So, you know, producers basically, it works on a point structure. So we get paid, if you're producing the record, you get part of the MSRP. So if a record, just for example, sells for $10 and mm-hmm. I get 3 points, I get 3 cents per record sold.
Okay.
So if you do the math out on this, if we have a $16 MSRP, I make about 45 cents. If I produce the whole record, I get about 45 cents a record.
Okay.
And now you multiply that by every million sales, means we make $500,000 per million. And then you look at Backstreet, who sold 30 million.
Oh,
yeah. So this is the Rick Rubin's.
How long were you at Backstreet?
Yeah. it was, the whole time was lucrative for all of us.
Right.
But I think really what it comes down to is as things progress forward, when we, and there's so much about the music business that, look, there's no major corporation that is not there to take your money and take your
and
money from the artist.
That's what I was getting ready to ask, because producers for a while got a bad rap. And the only reason that people in the rock star industry couldn't even make money was to tour.
Yeah.
And a lot of, I remember news about that and trying to change that, but I don't think it went anywhere just based on that. But I mean, so.
It's interesting because it's an 80-20. So the old record business.
Okay.
Let's just call it just for generic numbers, an 80-20 split. The label would take 80% of the record. You would get 20% as the artist.
Okay.
Just in generic terms. But when you went on tour, now the label gets 20% and you take 80. So that's okay. why you always heard bands. Now, and the other thing is, and I'm not pro-label, anti-label. I know that they've built my career.
Right.
I've always been on majors. I've always worked for majors.
Right.
And I have had a great career. I've had a very right. fortunate career because of that. But in the same vein, a t-shirt, like, so Taylor's out doing this tour. It, you know, when she's buying, pre-ordering, you know, 5 million t-shirts.
Right.
She's paying whatever it is. There's, even if she's paying $5 a shirt. Well, when you go to an arena show now, how much do you pay for a t-shirt? You pay $50, yeah. $60. So you look at that profit margin compared to a record that cost $1.5 million, $2 million, mm-hmm. and it sells for 15. Like it is, and there was that time, and that's the big shift. So when Spotify and, you know, Napster was interesting because, you know, Napster got shut down right when we were saying, we were blaming it all on piracy. Well, what it was everybody was starting this streaming platform because everybody knew the CD was dead. The CD format was a bad format.
Right.
And we knew there was a shelf life. So the labels, everybody was pivoting to be like, what's the next thing? Well, mm-hmm. streaming, cloud services, all those things were pre-in. We're working now today on immersive audio. And immersive audio won't hit really the general public for probably another 5 or 10 years as a common everyday thing. But Apple, the Vision Pro that comes out this year yeah. is like a lot of the music we have to deliver in this immersive format. So everybody, corporation.
Immersive.
Immersive define that for me. 3D space.
Okay.
So instead of like when you listen to stereo, there's left, right, and then things that appear in the middle are we call phantom center.
Okay.
So now with immersive audio, I can put things where you put headphones on and you hear stuff go around your head 360. I can move things in height. So it gives us a lot more immersive platform. So movies. Yeah, like when you go to a movie theater, it's that with music now. Yeah. So, but we've been working on this for years.
Wow.
And it's trickled into like TVs are Dolby Atmos certified now and all this other stuff. But again, another 5-10 years from now, this is going to be common. Like you're just going to like, if you hear mono, or it's like when the Beatles did, you know, their records, they were doing mono. Then they went to stereo and everybody thought they were crazy. Right. Then they went to quad and they thought they were crazy. Mm-hmm. And we just progressed so far forward. But I think that the piracy thing has always been there.
Okay.
And you look at the, and most of the industry, just so everybody kind of gets this, is if 2% of the industry is successful, everybody else gets to play. They'll lose. So an average record deal with a major label, a development deal is about $1.4 million. So if Justin Bieber pulls in almost $1 billion gross for Universal Music Group, I could do 100 artists and lose for the one that might be the next Justin Bieber. So right. they're playing that hedge game.
You met some of these people too?
Yeah. One of my good friends is actually the guy who's been with Justin since the beginning.
Really?
Yeah, he's literally done all of Justin's stuff. He's done Dua Lipa, J Balvin, Bad Bunny, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of interesting because it's like shooting sports. And like Eric Raffel knows all of, you know, the cool top shooters. It's like most producer engineers know, you know, and there's a lot of them.
Right.
You got to look, man, Nashville's massive. You know, Atlanta's massive.
Right. And that's a big thing as well because 90s, going in the late 90s, you know, there was a big, you know, went into a little hip hop and a lot of other stuff. Was there a lot of producers from the East Coast, West Coast?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because there's
coming
always
down this way towards Florida. Did you meet a lot of those other people?
Oh, tons of that. But it was like the big, like Puffy's got a place in Miami.
Right.
Like people that like Bad Boy's been down in Miami for almost 15
and
years.
You met these people?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You just say yeah, yeah. It was like running into. I mean, Puff last
week. Our world is different. It is like you know when we're out here shooting.
Well, I remember what got my attention. I said we need to stop talking because I want to do a podcast. Yeah. You said you're into music. I said okay. You started rock 90s. I said so. Trent Reznor.
Yeah.
And you're like,
I thought the funniest thing. Sometimes people think it comes off egotistical, but it's like it's so my everyday.
Yeah, of course.
Like it is. Like I said, like you walk around here, everybody looks at like Eric, and they're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And, you know, you walk up because you talked to Eric a million times and you're just like, yeah, it's just Eric or it's just, you know.
I get that 100%, but you got in my lane real quick when you started talking about Trent Reznor, Brian Warner, and some of these other people. Is this what made you buy a gun to get back on point because you're hanging out with these people?
So here's the interesting thing. So late 90s, I had a company that was based out of Melbourne, Australia.
Okay.
And so I would, through the 90s, I would be, you know, in Australia, I would go back and forth between here and then. I kind of was like, when I hit 30, I was kind of like, wait a second. This is, you know, my kid was, you know, kind of growing up. And I remember like my kid and I talk about it now. My kid just got into shooting, which is even funnier. But so we were talking and he remembers, you know, going to school. And I was in Australia. I'd call him on the phone and be like, you're getting ready to go to school. And like those kind of like the normal thing you hear about the music industry. You're gone all the time. I mean, Wes, one of our friends, is a touring musician. And, you know, he'll probably spend, you know, 40-50 weeks on the road.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to maintain everything. So I was like, okay, I just need to take a break. And so I took about a year, didn't do anything. And then it was interesting because I was like, okay, I was in that same position I was in with the paramedic thing. I don't want to go back to just making records full time.
Okay.
So the school, I lived here in Orlando and the school was like, maybe I'll go teach for a while. Just take a chill and just go teach. But because I wanted to stay up on my skills.
Well, okay.
So there's a media school.
You want to go teach, but so I take it you've won awards and stuff?
Oh, tons of them. Yeah. That's kind of one of the more embarrassing things. So
like Grammys?
I have Diamond Records, the Grammy stuff. I have, which actually kind of important to me is even in today's market, over the last, let's say, 4 years, I've had 22 Billboard number ones in gospel and pop music.
Really?
So there's no more unit sales because we don't sell records anymore. It's all streams.
Right.
So for us, one of the goals that me and my buddies kind of, you know, dig each other on, because we all have that, it's competitive. like, I got a number one this week, and I call up my buddy or send him a thing on Facebook, and he's like, oh, I just Cardi B, and you know, so it is really fun. I was actually, my friend Leslie, it's a really funny story, because I saw him the other day, and I'm like, so I, this 2024, I just came off literally second week of January, I got one of my Billboard number ones. Okay. And so I said to him, I said, I'm up one on you. He goes, I got Usher record coming out like in a week. And I was like, ah, you know, so we do have that banter, and that it's a friendly competition, not competition, because it's right. not really like what we do here in shooting, but right. it is that. So anyways, I was flying to England and back. I would never take vacation. I was not a vacation. I literally took like 2 weeks off.
Do you know anybody that worked with George Michael?
I have a good story for you about George Michael.
Love to hear the story. If you can share.
So we were in. No, there's nothing bad about it. George was great. So I was in Air Studios, which is George Martin's place in London, and I was redoing Diary of a Madman and Blizzard of Oz for the Aussie guys.
You've worked with Aussie,
yeah. So,
stick with George Michael, because my mind's all over the place.
This is really awesome. So you got to imagine. So like Bob Daisley, Lee Kerslake, Don Airey, the original keyboard player on those records and stuff, and we've got like. All kinds of, we got both studios downstairs booked. Well, there's a mix room upstairs at Air Studios. And, you know, we're going around, and it was a cool time, because in the music industry, George Martin's amazing. And I got to, you know, spend some time with him, and that was great. But, you know, everybody, they have like a kitchen, they have full-time chefs, and like, there's like this cool English pubish looking thing in the studio, in the actual, you know, studio. And I was like, okay, well, that's kind of odd, but. See George Michael walking. I'm like, so he's upstairs mixing a record while we're downstairs doing Ozzy and Crazy Train and Over the Mountain and Mr. Crowley and
all
this stuff.
You were helping with Crazy Train?
Yeah, well, so we redid the stuff. We redid those records. So those were done in 81. Okay. And both those records were done in a hot minute. Like literally, like both records were cut weeks.
You were remastering
so we're,
stuff.
Well, we're actually re-recording different versions.
Okay.
And we ended up getting this guy, Jimmy Barnes, who's a massive Australian rock singer. He was ended up doing the vocals because there's this big lawsuit with Sharon, and this thing all went kind of backwards.
You see the behind the scenes stuff with the Osbournes that TV.
Continue
with Michael watching.
So anyways, we're all just, it's the craziest thing, because everybody's in there. We're all, and they're little like pub, like literally booths.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's George Michael and his team, and we're over here with, you know, all the rock guys over here. And it's just like, everybody's casual, like, hey, what's going down? You know, like, and I always heard stories of that. Like so one of my friends was Bruce Boudin, who was the guy who did all the Michael Jackson stuff with Quincy.
Okay.
And, you know, they'd be just kicking it in the studio, and Prince would be in there, and, you know, like Michael's over here and, you know, whoever it is, you know, in the other studio. And I used to hear those kind of stories. And this was that first time I was like, how bizarre. And how polar opposites of people that are just sitting here eating, you know,
right.
You know, just talking, being like, hey, what's happening? You know? And yeah, so the experience of how normal those people are.
Yeah.
And spending time with super creatives. And that's, I think, the thing that everybody, you know, even Backstreet, they got a bad rap of we did everything, and we did a ton. But you had to have that talent. You couldn't stand up there and do what they did if they didn't have a magic bullet as well.
Right.
And that was kind of one of the craziest things to really come to terms with is that I was fortunate. I still every day tell people how fortunate I was to be around, you know, Steve Morris, Ritchie Blackmore, you know, Marty Balin from Starship, like just the people who iconically, you know, made music.
You get Christmas cards from these people?
Yeah, well, it's a weird. I am not a social person.
Okay.
So Roger and I had spent 14 months together, and when we see each other, it's great. But it's like I'm not the let me call you up and let's talk on the weekend. And the other thing with us is they have to live the record after we leave. Right. So we finish making a record, they go out and tour, and then so what do? I'm already on 5 other records by the time they even get started with their tour. Right. You know, we are literally record to record to record to record.
Your head's down going at it big time then.
So to get in shooting.
Yeah, I'm taking it, you're buying a gun, you got a kid, everything's, is this a normal story of self-protection that we've heard before?
It is not.
Okay, continue.
Not even close. Okay. So there was an indoor gun range across the street from the university where I was teaching.
Okay.
And they're like, you have to take vacation. I'm like, cool. So I take vacation. And one of my friends there knew that I was going to take vacation, fly to London, make a record and come back. So And it was cool because I was doing these like mid 2000 supergroups. So we were doing, it was, I think the first one was like Glenn Hughes, Dave Navarro, Chad Smith was playing drums for us. And oh my gosh, Dave's, yeah, he's awesome too.
Continue.
And so then all those, like, there's this whole thing. I don't know if you've heard of Chickenfoot, but Satriani and Jason Bonham and like all these kind of, all of a sudden, like, is again, this group of people is like, hey, you're playing on, let's together and jam and do whatever. So I was doing these kind of super group things. And he's like, you got to stop this. Like, you're heading back to the same trajectory you left to come here to calm down with. And he's like, you know, hey, there's a range across the street. Lunchtime, let's just go shoot some guns. I'm like, I don't shoot guns. I don't know anything about
it. Somebody wanted to go shoot guns across the street.
Yeah. So, and it's across from a university, which was even the funnier awesome. Thing. Indoor range, small place. And it was a weird thing because I am A-type personality to the nth degree. And, you know, so I literally, we go over there, we shoot guns, and they're like, hey, we're going to start this indoor competition thing. Competition? I'm like, I'm in. I literally shot a match probably
so this
a
is
day
not,
or two after I shot a pistol for the first time.
This is not bowling.
This is not bowling.
You had no gun experience.
I had nothing at that point. So I bought an M&P.
Okay.
That day.
Okay.
I'm like, what do I need? And so again, Jonathan from Red Dot. So this was, Red Dot was, he's still, I think, down in Malabar, but Red Dot would sell USPSA belts. He'd go to all the shoots. He was just like you.
Yeah.
Like Red Dot was everywhere.
Okay.
And I was like, oh my gosh, I need a belt. I need a holster. All the normal things that everybody goes through gets into shooting. And so we did these indoor matches. I shot production for like maybe a year and a half or whatever. And, it was kind of a cool thing. Casey Yasubia was, because Steel Nationals used to be in Titusville a lot.
Right.
And so I spent a day shooting with Casey and I was like, oh, I'm going to get an open gun. So I literally, it was kind of a funny thing. I don't remember if it was Shannon or Dave Pruitt or one of those. I think it might have been Shannon I bought it.
Right.
Well, I'd have to ask him. So anyways, somebody was waiting for their like Brazo custom to be built and they bought a Trubor. And they were like, well, I don't need this Trubor because I got my other gun coming. And I was like, oh, I'll buy it, whatever. And so I was like, and that was, production was cool because I love the reloading. I don't know, but most people who start production love reloading.
Right.
And now, if you know, I shoot PCC. Come on. Let's like, the reloading's highly overrated. So we shot the competitions indoors. And then there was a couple that was there, husband and wife, Tammy and Cliff Boardwell. And they were in the shooting sport already. Mm-hmm. And Central Florida would have outdoor USPSA matches. Right. And they're like, oh, this. And it's one of the things I love about shooting the most. Thankfully, I shoot for a really cool team.
Right.
And there's this camaraderie that I had the same, believe it or not, with Purple.
Okay.
Like there's a group of people you shoot with commonly. And there's goods and bads to that. Because it's like, so with Purple, we knew we had come to the end of what we were going to do as a group.
Right.
Not to kind of go back to that, but you know, there was writing started happening a little bit separate, the band. And so John Lord and I kind of like exited around that same time. We started doing some projects together, but there was a unit like, and so the group you shoot with, like, I see this all the time. It's like, you know, Gorka and I shoot together two, three times a week for the last few years.
Right.
And that's as much a part, like Wednesdays, we do Action Steel here
at
Volusia County. And it's funny because there's guys that are like, you know, they're literally, it's like people who go to a bar to hang out with their buds.
Right.
We just do it with guns.
So
I know it's crazy.
When you first started doing guns, though, some industries are not very pro-gun. Right. I mean, I've known a gentleman that used to shop at Steyr Arms in Birmingham, but could not have any pictures made with a firearm at all based on the agreement he had with Apple.
Right.
And they made stuff behind the scenes. So when you went back into guns and music, did you share that with anybody? Was that something you just kind of, it was just kind of like, this is my church on the weekends. I don't really talk about religion.
No, it's kind of a weird thing. So I don't ever remember making a big deal out of it.
Okay.
Because honestly, I think it's just like any other sport. First 5 years you do it, you're just trying to find yourself and save yourself.
Okay.
So I didn't really think it was anything more than that. you know, weekend hobby, couple times a month thing. And it really wasn't at that point. We didn't have this range. This range, right. You know, we have matches all the time. So, right. We, you know, can step up. I think personally that, you know, I've had great support. Like the board, the chairs, everybody knows I'm a competitive shooter. Mm-hmm. Everybody is like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. We don't throw it out as part of my PR stuff.
Have you had stars, rock stars want to come shoot with you? Gosh.
Like I got my buddy who does all the Justin Bieber stuff. He's a Marine.
Yeah.
And he's like, so he's busy in LA doing stuff.
Right.
And we have this thing at the university. We do this Hall of Fame. I'm like, hey, Josh, are you coming in for Hall of Fame? He's like, if we can go to the range.
Nice.
So there's, look, and it's kind of crazy that there is, you know, I don't want to just bring somebody out and hack and slash with guns, but it's like, 100%. There are people who are like, yeah. And so I've never had any backlash from even the university.
Well, there's certain stars you see always, you know, going to TTI and
oh, 100%,
doing, yeah. doing stuff and everything else. And the education there is great. And we, yep. we love that as advocates for the shooting sports, sure. and Second Amendment to see that kind of stuff. But I'm sure you work with people that have stayed behind the scenes based on their record agreements as well, correct?
I don't think so. Really? I honestly, okay. I don't think there's any, you know, so rap and hip hop world.
Yeah.
That is one of those where people are not shooting. They're playing with guns.
Yeah.
And so I always had that rule. I even had that with I didn't do a ton of rap and hip hop, but one of the rules I always had in the studio is because I remember one day we were in and the top of the console, literally a guy comes in and just puts a 9mm down. This was before I was shooting.
Yeah.
So I was just like, I always had that rule. I was like, you want to have guns, you do your stuff. And I was similar that way with drugs. You right. know, you want to go kill yourself in the hotel room, that's right. your biz. But I understand it's part of everything, but there's no need to have guns we are in a concrete bunker, a protected space.
Right.
Most celebrities, I was doing Patti LaBelle. And oh. that was the first time I really saw true security, not the flashy security.
Okay.
So this, you know, Patty's not super, super tall woman.
Right.
So she comes in and we're talking and I see this like 6'4", 6'5" dude come in. And I was like, that dude. And they're like, oh, that's, you know, Patty's security. And I'm like, okay. And she had a panic button. No she didn't kidding. Want, so she literally, so he stood in the lobby and it wasn't like people were after Patty the Bell. She's right. not that kind of person,
yeah.
but she just needed to have that, you security. Know, whatever. And that was the first time I was like, oh, that's a real, like, he's not flashy. He's not anything. I
he's
was
designed
like,
to come
yeah,
in.
He the, was designed.
If the light goes off, he's designed to come in and take care of that.
I was good. I was like, how cool is that? And that yeah. is actually, when people ask me about my music career. That mm-hmm. is the one, people are like, what is that? Like, is there, because everybody thinks it's Purple and everything. And look, the first time you hear the band play Smoke on the Water, or there's a version of Lazy that we did in Australia in 99. Probably the best version of the song ever. I remember magic moments of all that stuff, but I sat on a road case and it was Patti LaBelle, Ray Charles, and Natalie Cole. They were all doing this thing and Patti sat down on a road case next to me and started singing, no microphones, no anything. And this one of the few times in my life for a musician, I've had the, you know, the chills. And I was just like, I understood magic. Then. Wow. I understood how special she was. I could now relate that to Diana Ross and all these other people that were, you know, those, you know, the Beatles, those kind of guys, like that kind of thing really did hit home.
Right.
But yeah, to go back to the shooting thing, it was just out of necessity of you can't go make records on your break.
Right.
And that turned into, I think I probably, you know, obviously there's been a few times, but I've pretty much shot every weekend for, right. you know, 15, 16 years.
Well, I'm sure there's people listening going, you know, oh, great. He shoots production, all this something. And you said the PCC were, and they were like, oh, it's one of those guys.
Yeah.
Well, what got you into PCC?
So I shot open for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And I was that open shooter
yeah.
who just liked to go fast.
Okay.
Like I loved everything. I mean, I got cars and the race car thing and we'd okay. autocross and go to Sebring. And like, I loved the whole adrenaline
thing. You had some disposable income.
Yes.
Sound like.
Yeah. Well, so the crazy thing is I shot open and then all of a sudden my arm, I started getting the golfer's elbow or whatever mm-hmm. it's called. And my pinky was getting numb. And I thought it was, so when we went to the computer world, usually consoles are like 15 feet and you know, slide back and forth. But when we got to trackballs, I thought it was me using trackball too much in
okay.
the style. So anyways, I was like, wow, my arm's really hurting when I shoot. So I stopped shooting for about a month. My arm got almost instantly better. And I was like, okay, well, it's had time to heal. It's good. I picked up the open gun again. And it was like immediately my pinky started. Right at that point in time, this PCC thing, it was right before, probably 6 months before it really blew up with the first PCC Nationals in Frostburg.
All right.
And, you know, I had the open thing. So anybody who shoots open understands this. I was like, well, I can't shoot. I don't want to go back to production. That was ridiculous. And, you know, whatever. You know, after you shoot open, there's really no going back at that point, in my opinion. But so I was shooting open and I was like, well, up here, Dave had sold a couple rifles up here to a couple of the guys.
Okay.
And I said, I was like, look, what is the best rifle that's going to run? Because I knew one of the things with open was open guns get finicky. I shot a true bore. Never messed with it. You could pick a round up off the ground, stick it in that thing, and it would shoot. You know, it was literally best gun probably I've ever had. And I was like, what's the best rifle I can get? And they're like, well, buy this DaVinci thing. So I literally called up Dave, said, I want a turnkey rifle minus the dot. I drove to St. Pete, picked it up, and literally been running that. You know, now you don't obviously shoot for Dave, but yeah, it's like, course. I mean, it has literally been... I love it. And when I started getting into, like, you know, you have that rough, like, just call it that first year or whatever. But I actually feel like it's so much home. Like, revolver guys obviously get more crap than we do. But, you know, PCC world it just feels like home to me.
Right.
And that's what I love about the sport.
Yeah.
Is, you know, Gorka Shoots Limited, which is, all know it's kind of going, you know, it's, you know, so he, you know, grabs his, you know, cool Infinity limited optics gun, you know, and, you know, comes out and plays with that. But it's like, I can see when he shoots optics, like he's great. He's a great shooter, period. You know, everybody knows, you know, Gorka's an amazing shooter. So he can pick up anything and shoot. But when I see him pick up that 40, it's like, I see that's his home. Like that's his happy place.
Right.
And that's what I feel about rifle. I love it. You know, we get to travel, like we're literally in Aruba in April and, you know, IPSC is, I mean, this wasn't even a topic until I started shooting rifle.
Right.
I didn't know anything about IPSC. It wasn't a big thing here in the States, obviously. And, like this match that's going on right now is amazing to me because it's people from all over the world.
Yes.
There's tons of real shooters here. Not that, you know, there isn't a USPSA or anything else. It's
Airs
just
don't
like
walk into mini matches.
No, but it's just a different it's energy. And I love that.
Right.
And, you know, when we went to Aruba the first time, it was kind of more of an exhibition thing. And this year we've got two full squads of PCC shooting. And I think it's just awesome to be able to, you know, bring that in, you know, understand that not everybody is fluent in rifle.
Right.
And doesn't have to be.
Right.
You know, like it's not for everybody.
Right.
You know, we have our own challenges, you know, for sure.
And now, you know, you got a kid. It's getting ready to start.
Yeah. So my kid, when I say kid, he's a lot older than everybody thinks I am, but he's 30.
Oh.
But he builds race cars. And so he's been in the, and you know, he's been drag racing. I think I gave him a Mustang Cobra was his first car. Like, and he was on the drag strip, I think, before he drove on the street. It was kind of funny. But, so he does like all the wiring harnesses for all the, GT3, like Porsche stuff. So all that, he does that. So anyways, he had shot a few times in the past, but he's like, I think I want to start, you know, doing that.
Right.
So we just recently, I guess it would be like 2 months ago.
Right.
We got him the Canic, you know, he's got the Coup de Dot and, you know, I'm like, here's how the reloading stuff works. Good luck.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's definitely old enough with all that, but it's like, you know, and it's, we used to race cars together. We go autocross and do whatever. And I've been very fortunate because I know a lot of people don't get that with their kids, but, you know, so he's been out here on Saturdays with us shooting.
Right.
And, you know, I'm just kind of like right now, just like do it as long as we can before, you know, he goes off and does his thing. And
right. And that makes sense because now you're in a kind of an educational situation now.
Yeah.
The schools. Or all these different kind of rules, what you can talk about, what you can't talk about.
Yep.
Do you feel that you have a pathway to educate people on the advantages of gun safety and defending yourself? Or do you feel like it's just a non-topic based on how it is with the universities and stuff?
Well, here's the interesting thing. Again, it's not anything that you know, gets brought up to students or any of that. But right. a lot of people find out that I do it and they ask a lot of questions. And that's one of the things I've always been, I want to say, really supportive of, and I think should be pushed more, is I don't care if it's IDPA, USPSA, IPSC, Action Steel, you going and standing in front of whatever mm-hmm. and shooting a gun five times and thinking you have gun handling, gun safety.
Right.
I always explain to everybody, one of the things that I think is important about our sport is how we've been doing this, probably done stages hundreds, some people thousands, Eric, tens of millions of times.
Right.
But when that buzzer goes off, we know what's coming and you panic. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, when you do actually hear something, like, can you, and that's worst case scenario. Yep. We're awake, we're focused, we've walked stages. And, you know, as much as you train at home and everything else, I had one of the actual vice presidents of the school ask if I would go over and kind of just go over some stuff about their home and how to, and I was really? Like, if you're not going to practice, if you're not going to come out and learn how to move with a gun, how to do the stuff. No, because that is one of those things that I think is, it's more dangerous to not be educated. It's, I don't care who you take. I mean, look up here, we've got six hours here at this range full time. They have their own bays. You can learn rifle. You can learn pistol. Gorka, Manny, Shannon Smith's here. Like, we have some of the most amazing people who will train you in everything from, you know, self-defense, home defense to competition stuff. But I think, and even the SIG guys, they come out and they'll shoot a match and it's a different ballgame.
Right.
But they come out and shoot matches because they want to move and they want to have to acquire targets and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I think the stigma of shooting, and that's what I always love. And for me, I am about the sport.
Right.
And when people see there is a real true sport to this, and you can be as competitive as you want, it brings everything to the table. I call it golf on steroids because, you know, we're running around shooting bullets, but you get a bad grip, you know, you have to, you know, you lose your ball. It's the same thing.
Right.
So I think, and when people come out, as we all know, you know, you come out and shoot a couple matches, it's hard to not come back.
Right.
And, but I think that that's the thing. When I first started shooting, IDPA was, that's all I heard was, oh, IDPA is the entry level thing. And I don't really hear that much anymore. I, you know, hear people shooting Steel Challenge as an entry level thing.
Yes.
And, you know, I know IDPA is strong, but it's, I don't know if that's a Florida thing. Probably is. But I don't hear as much about IDPA, and our matches are not even close to as big as USPSA.
Right.
And then for us, you know, Action Steel is a big thing because we shoot all year round. And so we do a ton of the Action Steel, which is just, you know, hose it and have fun. And people, a lot of people come just to shoot, you know, which is fun.
Amazing. Are you still getting phone calls from other people wanting to do stuff that you're having to turn down? Or are you still wanting to do things? Or what's the music world look like to you now besides teaching?
So I it's an interesting thing. I'm going to try and keep this as brief as I can. About three, just before COVID, I was doing, one of my friends is an opera singer from Vienna, and they were in town. We were doing this. We were doing a benefit thing for human trafficking. So it was going to the opera world. We were going to get a bunch of donations, whatever. Anyways, I did all the strings. I had my friends sequence them, which is computer-based versus live strings, because the opera world, everything is live. And I wanted to kind of knee-jerk them and be like, look, here's this cool project. Take notice of it. It's not your normal stuff. So I needed a cello player. And so this cello player comes in. He's the director for the Orlando Philharmonic. He plays with Yo-Yo Ma. Great cello player. He's like, ah, my wife's an artist, and she's been looking for somewhere to record. I mean, I hear this 24/7.
Really?
Yeah. It's like, oh, can you listen to my kids' music? Or, you know, I mean, this is just kind of the, goes with the territory.
Right.
So anyways, I was like, all right, I'll meet with her. So she comes in. I'm like, I was pretty hardcore too. I don't know if she remembers the conversation, but anyways, I was like, you know, look, this is just like dating. We're going to go in, we're going to do this, we're going to make some music. If we're not jiving, you don't need it and I don't. Let's just, you know, not waste each other's time. We've been together for the last 3-4 years. And it's been full circle because music technology has changed. And her name is Aoife O'Donovan. She's from the States. She's from Boston, basically.
Right.
But, you know, Irish and everything. I didn't know she was a 3-time Grammy winner for Americana and folk.
Okay.
So we started doing a bunch of songs together. The last record we did, we have a new one coming out this March of this year. But which is a really good record. We'll just talk about it for a second. But the last record we did, we got Grammy nominations for Best Folk Album, Best Americana Performance, and Best Americana Song. So, and we also won Folk Song of the Year for the folk global thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, it's probably the most proud creative stuff I've done. There's no computer tuning. Everybody played every note of everything. It's artistically done. It's not made to sell a bunch of records. It is for you to put on and go into a place and enjoy it. This new record that we did over the last, it's taken us about 2.5 years, but so she got commissioned to do some songs for Women's Rights to Vote. So in, you know, I think it was, whatever it is, 1917 or something like that, the suffragette movement happened for women to get rights to vote. Mm-hmm. So anyways, she did 4 or 5 songs, I think, we put together for that. We were in the middle of making this other record, so we kind of put them on the back burner, knowing that they were going to be the next catalyst for the next record. We've ended up finishing that record, and so it's a really crazy record, because in today's day and age, you do everything for the instant, you know, the TikTok stream, the whatever. Mm-hmm. This is a concept record that you put on. We have vinyl, you put it on, you listen to it from front to back, but it's about women's rights to vote from that time period. It's about her relationship with her mom and her relationship with her daughter, because she's a mom now. So it's this whole path in today's political world and everything else that goes on. This is kind of, it's a very artistic thing, right? But it's all real, all full real, all live strings, all every right. bit of it is real people playing. And you don't get to do that in the music industry as much as we used to. Wow. And so for me, it's kind of weird that I started with a band who was that.
Yeah.
And I'm not done with my career. We're still making records.
Right.
I do a ton of gospel records.
Okay.
Like Kirk Franklin to, you know, the pretty much everybody in the gospel world. But,
right.
And it's kind of an interesting thing, because they just want their records to sound great. They don't right. care if you're religious, non-religious, guns, non-guns. They don't right. care. And that's the cool thing. And that's kind of an interesting thing when you ask that. Never had everybody knows everybody that works with me knows right. I'm like, this is a priority for me too,
right?
And never had any backlash from that's that cool. at all.
You ever met Chris Stapleton? He came out of nowhere.
No, so I do have a bunch of friends, actually, interesting, you know, kind of project that's coming up that's not a secret or anything,
right.
but I'm gonna forget his name. He was the World Series, he was a pitcher for the Cardinals, coming off, he's won a World Series or whatever.
Right.
But so he's leaving baseball, going into country music. So
yeah.
there's a bunch of stuff that's happening kind of around him transitioning in, which is always interesting to me, because coming from another, you know, occupation, especially coming from the sports, going into music,
right.
you don't hear all that often, you
right.
know, but
so many yeah. crossovers now. That's why I asked that question.
Yeah, there really is. I think that, you know, country music took over where it's kind of interesting. So Matchbox 20, the light rock stuff.
Mm-hmm.
kind of went away with popularity, and country
right.
music was like, hey, there's this kind of cool thing that they were making millions right. and millions and millions. So you have the Keith Urbans, you have all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And that's really, I think, where pop country is,
right.
is in the light rock. Fans are fanatical.
Right.
They buy merch. They know
right.
every word to the song.
You get invited to shows a lot?
I do. I don't go to shows. My girlfriend will tell you that'll piss her off a little bit, but it's like, first off, it's really hard to detect. I love
okay.
music,
okay.
but when I go there and I'm listening, I'm like, oh, that vocal's like too bright, or what's this PA doing?
You're too
or what do they have?
You can't enjoy it because you're deciphering everything. It's not enjoyable. I
yeah.
guess.
And I don't, so artists have show mode. And so I actually, like, even when Purple comes down, I don't like to go see them, because
right.
they're not the guys I know in the studio.
Okay.
They have to, like, and I've always related it to, like, I remember the first time we were in Australia and there was like 15,000 people, and I'm standing on the side of the stage going, like, how, but so they get into that mode.
I understand that.
And
I can relate with
that. I know now I don't want to be around you when you're in that mode. You are
right.
putting on what people perceive you as being. And I fortunately get to know them not from that first.
Right.
And I get to know them for who they really are, and spend, you know, literally as producers, engineers, mixers, we spend the most intimate time.
Who do you, this is your opinion.
Please. Yeah. Yeah.
Who do you think has the best show mode that would shock people?
Oh my gosh, that is a completely.
You know,
I mean,
for an example, I'll give you. Like we know Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails. Yeah, when he's on stage, he is just insane. You don't know he's in control, but he's in control. And then Trent behind the scenes is recluse and does a lot of things behind the scenes.
You know, and the crazy thing, you don't
even see the guy.
People don't even know how many movie soundtracks that.
Oh, and he's done a lot. I know.
And how creative.
Yes. So that's my example who we know just based on, because I know a little bit about Trent. I read some of his stuff. Brian Warner's the same way, who is Marilyn Manson. He's on stage putting out a show, ripping up Bibles and having a crazy time. Oh, then behind the scenes, he's quiet, reserved, and everything else.
This is the thing. So
I'm taking two of your ideas away.
I know.
These people.
So Brian actually was what semi came to mind, because I also knew Brian when it was Brian.
Okay.
And as that transition happened, like Twiggy that was playing drums with him and stuff, and like guy who did a ton of work with him.
Twiggy was a guitar player.
See, I know my Marilyn Manson. Shocker.
But look, you cannot be who he is.
Right.
And that's not all fake.
Right.
But there's the show part of that. Okay. Like, and Brian is a super, like, but I do think one of the things that I think is interesting is, like, even Britney. I use Britney as the example. The Britney, I don't know the Britney everybody else knows.
Okay.
I know the 14-year-old Britney. I know the girl who was trying. I know the girl who was polite. Mm-hmm. I know the girl who hadn't been through what she had been through.
Okay.
And so that's a super, like, I knew Rob Thomas and the guys from Creed, like Scott, before Scott, you know, went and did, you know, all that. Mm-hmm. Seeing how they start drinking their own Kool-Aid.
Okay.
That's the demise of the rock star.
Okay.
In my mind, you know, there was a time when Tommy, you know, all the crew guys, you know, hair metal was a thing. You knew what you were going into, but then after a while, that's your 24/7.
Right.
And that's usually what happens to artists. And so for me, it's not the show mode. It's how many people on the back end of being famous. Like Smashing Pumpkins, you know, Billy Corgan, you know, notorious. He's still notorious for just being Billy.
Yeah.
But that was before and after in between.
Yeah.
So like there's never been
some pretty dark areas of the 90s.
He still knows what he wants and he's going to get what he wants. That's happening today with the whole Pumpkins going out, you know? And you know, I think that is probably, it's not so much the show mode as the watching people transition.
Right.
Like, so the boy band thing, there's a tiny bit of guilt from everybody because they were taught how to interview, walk, talk, listen. And it is, look, we have it in the shooting sports. You can see people pushing kids to be.
Oh, wow. What a correlation. You're seeing some of that.
Oh, I see it.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
I see it.
We see parents pushing their kids to be a certain way.
Yeah, which a lot of us
semi-scratch
our head because there's very few career shooting sports things.
A very, very small percentage.
And, you know.
But there's kids out there chasing it.
100%. You know,
that's not really wrong, but
I don't think it's wrong, but I think it can be
dangerous based on what you're saying as well.
At what point is the choice?
Right.
And as we now know, you know, I'm not sure of his name, but the PCC Philippines, younger guy. It's like, you know, okay, well, what was before that?
Yeah.
You know, was he now everybody I know loves to shoot.
Yeah.
But is it a career thing and how much you push and how much you train and how much you do? And then where is, for this is a weird sport. Where's the back end for that?
Right.
If you come up in karting, Lewis Hamilton and all the money and the stories are all the same for everything, even musicians. But there's the end game of I can be a superstar. I can do things that nobody else in the world's going to do. Mm-hmm. You know, Max, you know, is... I mean, I saw, you know, the early Max Michelle.
Yeah.
You know, he was the mythical, oh my gosh, there's Max Michelle. Mm-hmm. And you know, to this trajectory where he's just, you know, he's just a shooter now.
Yeah.
You know, he makes great money doing what he does. And but I'm just like, you know, how many Eric Raffels, how many Maxes? There's very, very few in our sport. So
even JJ Ricaz is
starting. JJ. Yeah. And
really young.
I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think that it is. I see people doing it in the music. I saw it for the mid-90s. People would walk in because Britney had blown up. The Backstreet Boys had blown up. People would show up. We'd audition their kids. And I would straight up tell their parents, this is how this is going to go down. They're going to go to interview lessons. They're going to have a fitness coach. They're going to go in the studio. They're going to go to vocal lessons. They are going to be machines. and we are going to put millions and millions of dollars behind them. And the parents would look me dead in the eye and go, where do we sign up? And I'm like, do you not hear what I just said?
Right. They you just know? Heard the $1 million.
Yeah. And I'll pick on Backstreet Boys. You know, like I remember after things were blown up for them, AJ was one that, you know, I remember you just saw the turmoil inside.
Right.
You know, and then you start seeing the turmoil in the band. Then they don't know, like everybody goes away. Like when you're not famous, everybody goes away. And it's like, okay, well, that's where the child actors, child musicians, you know, I do feel bad for, you know, some of the artists that a lot of people look at, like Justin, man, this kid has lived that life.
He knows
nothing else.
He is so talented.
Way more talented than anybody will ever give him credit for. But he is always, I think you hear that in music, you see that in him. He's ping pong sometimes, right. You know, where it's like he's searching for who is Justin.
Right.
Because again, it's really hard to separate out who that is.
No doubt. Based on you meeting so many people.
Yeah.
And talking to people all the time. Is your cell phone like locked 7 different times with different phone numbers in there with all these people you've met throughout the years?
No, it is kind of weird sometimes.
Because you could just pick up the phone and reach out to some of these people if you had to.
Yeah.
Because you made friendships with some of them.
Yeah, one of the, like my girlfriend knows because I brought her to a show, but we were doing these, I called it, for lack of a better term, I called it billionaire karaoke.
Okay.
So there's this country artist named Neil McCoy. He's a big deal.
I don't listen to country much, but I know Neil.
Okay, so Neil, we would fly Neil and a full crew of Nashville session players in, and there's a couple of, let's just call them super rich people that wanted to, we do like, you know, Toto songs and, you know, whatever. And this was like, we were recording and doing this so that they could basically sing over top, but we have just literally spent tens of thousands of dollars, private jets, buses, the whole thing. Think about rock school that you've heard of. We were just doing this for these individuals. So anyways, out of the blue, they're like, hey, Rob Schneider's coming in. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he goes, oh, no, Deuce Bigelow's coming in, you know, or whatever. So anyways,
Rob. His daughter's a singer now.
Yeah, she's in a little hot water right now.
She's got a little issue she did with Dolly, but she's going
to let the dust settle. So anyways, Rob comes in.
Yeah.
And, you know, we ended up doing a couple of things. And Rob was one of the most, and he's one of the most intellectual people. I mean, you know, he goes on his little health nut things and everything else, but he will sit and have a conversation about anything. And he knows a ton of, he's super smart, super intellectual.
Okay.
Like one of the funnest dudes to just like, not because of the comedy, because he's just a great person.
Right.
So anyways, you know, so he comes and does this. But one of the things I thought was interesting is one of the singers who's not a singer, he was, I think, a plastic surgeon or something like that. And I watched Rob teach him how to be this person. And Rob goes, okay, I'm going to come out. I'm going to, you know, so we set up and do a different song. And Rob goes, watch this. I'm going to do Roy Orbison. And there is, I think, somewhere's out there released. But I swear you would think Roy Orbison was singing. And Rob was like, look, I have to be in that character as an actor, as a comedian, being on Saturday Night Live, all that stuff.
Yeah.
He was teaching this guy how to be the character that he wanted to sing. I was like, oh my gosh, as a producer, if I could have bottled this moment. And then of course, then he does, you know, Get Her Done or whatever. Yeah. Like, it's just like, it's always the Rob thing. Oh, and this was a funny story that you'll like. Me and Julio, Paul Simon's on.
Okay.
So Rob has a TV show that was on Netflix, and Rob and I were doing that song for the tail end credits at the end of the last show of this series.
Okay.
And so we run in the studio, we do the song, run back over to where we were editing the thing, and Paul Simon was in like Hawaii or something. We call Paul Simon up and we're like, man, you know, can you listen to this version? And Paul looked on the phone, he goes, why did you change the lyrics to my song? Rob and I looked at each other. So Rob had Googled the lyrics for the song, and whatever it was wrong. We literally run back over to the studio, recut it. We're like, oh my gosh. And then, so it's kind of this like,
so he was not happy.
No, it was, he was laughing about it.
Oh, okay.
But it was like, you got to think, this is Paul Simon.
Yeah.
You are calling Paul Simon like on speed dial to go, hey, thanks for letting us do this song. You want to hear the version? And you're like, you have the wrong lyric there. And we were like, oh my gosh, do we feel like idiots? So anyways, yeah, it's fun, man. And look, you know, what you've done for the shooting sports, like, cause me, like, again, Red Dot was a big, you know, just support of, yeah, of the shooting sports. And then, you know, I started seeing you, and then our, you know, relationship started, like,
yeah, we've known each other for a while.
Oh my gosh.
And I just found out this weekend, even what you did. Yeah. I said, don't say another word. We got to sit down and do a podcast. That's usually how I like to do the show. Yeah. So it's just been a lot, but you know, there's drama in the shooting sports.
Yeah.
Is there just, I can't imagine what kind of drama would be in the music world.
You can't.
So what we're going through now is nothing.
There are some unnamed pop artists who have thrown away tens of millions of dollars. Wow. Because over COVID, everything else, yeah, they're just like, the record's not me, I don't like this. And you have to talk them off the cliff all the time. The biggest drama right now is, how does an artist get paid?
Right, because there's a lot. You brought up TikTok earlier.
Yeah, so but we have a lot of drama going on with that. You want to talk about drama? Well, it's all over the news.
The drama with TikTok, but you we talked about a little bit about it. TikTok's actually used for your advantage as well.
So it was until last week.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and this will, it will fix itself.
Right.
So Universal Music Group is the powerhouse. They own about, roughly, let's call it 35% of the recording industry globally.
Right.
So they're the largest singular entity, Warner Brothers, and then independents are about 30%. Mm-hmm. Warner Brothers and Sony are the other, you know, chunk of what's happening. So Universal decided, so they were under a contract with TikTok as a company. So I'm assuming this was a long-term, I'm not in the privy to what the contract was, but right, the contract was up. So it went into renegotiation. And Universal said, look, you know, you're making too much money off us, X, Y, and Z. What that became was Universal tried to strong arm. We're the biggest, you know, we have Taylor, we have, and literally Taylor right now, as of probably today, is still not on TikTok. It'll say music not available or copyright, you know, situation, right, or infringement or whatever.
This is like DirecTV saying you're not getting Fox 6, yeah, or your Fox affiliate, oh, or your CBS affiliate. So it's a big, massive, big fight.
So the problem is, the way the analytics show, more people go and stream, whether it's YouTube. YouTube is the one that pays out the most for everybody.
Okay.
So Spotify doesn't really pay. It's more advertising, whatever. But it's stream numbers. You can go to the other services. But what happened was TikTok is what gets songs out now. Just example, Chris Stapleton. You know, mm-hmm, he does a song. It's going to be in a 15-second TikTok. That drives the majority of music industry, new music streams. And it is still a place where new artists can get heard, because it takes one guitar player virtuoso to play something and it gets put in, you know, and then you get the connection. So Universal felt like, hey, we're just going to strong arm, get what we want. And TikTok said, not happening. Take your music, pull it. Because you are 30%, let's call it, of the market. Yeah. I still have 70%. So I don't know what game you think you're playing.
Right.
Ultimately, the prediction and what everybody in our industry is saying is that Universal will play. They may get another point or two or whatever their mojo is. But they need, Universal artists are going to be super pissed. And they already are.
Because, like, they don't have any way to sample their music otherwise.
Yeah. So, and...
Maybe they'll go to Rumble.
Look, there's a window. I know, but there's a window that's open so much for new artists right now.
Right?
This, like, if everybody is not just pushing stuff as fast as they can on TikTok, while, right, you have 30% of the biggest player that has the biggest artist, who normally the person who's going to do a TikTok, you know, reel or whatever it is, right, is going to put somebody, like Crazy Chain goes in or whatever.
Right.
So with all that being down, you have an opportunity now to get your music up there, have somebody hit it way more, like, right, way more, you know, in the AI algorithm, because everything's AI algorithm. Whatever you, right, scroll, whatever you look at is determining what you're getting fed.
And music's going to AI too, I guess, right?
Yeah. So I'm teaching now to not let AI do it, but use it as a tool. If you tell young kids, so I mean, my kids aren't young because I teach college and, mm-hmm, I teach senior level, like, you know, end of bachelor's degree people. And I'm like, look, you are not going to fight and get rid of AI. Not going to happen.
Right.
Lawyers know it. Everybody knows it. And this is the actor strike. But if you teach them how to use it as a tool to get from point A to point B and not have it be a crutch, that's the thing I think that hurts everybody is when, well, it's just like shooting. if you don't learn grip, if you're shooting a pistol, you're just wasting money. You know, so understanding that there are tools and, you know, doing the right thing at the right time.
Right.
And so for me, I'm encouraging them. I'm like, look, go and use something to get you a song idea. I'll pick on the AI voice thing. Okay. So Drake's licensing his voice. So if I was a hip hop artist, I could put together a track. I could pitch it to an artist better than if I can't sing or rap or do whatever.
Right.
And I can't sing. And it's kind of funny because one of my biggest artists that I'm working with now is a singer-songwriter.
Right.
But I don't sing. So if I wanted to pitch her a song, like even as a songwriter, I can play guitar, I can play drums and piano, I could put that all together, but I can't sing. So I'm like, oh, how am I going to do this? Well, now I can actually sing in the melody and then I can put Ed Sheeran's voice onto that. Not to sell it as Ed Sheeran's song, but right. as a pitch to somebody. So I think they're valuable tools if they're used correctly. You know, and I do think that trying to run from technology is not the right answer for us.
Right.
We need to take the young generations and bring them into technology in a positive way.
Right.
Because if we don't, guess what they do? They're going to sit at home. They're going to hack and slash. They're right. going to steal beats. They're going to steal music and really not going to help anybody. So.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot to unpack.
But I'm thankful we got to do it because, you know, I do the show and it's about shooting, but it's about personal, and I like getting behind the scenes behind the lens on a lot of things that I do with people to understand things better. So, you know, hopefully more and more opportunities are going to come where you're going to be able to, you know, do more things with the Second Amendment in the way that you're with the stuff you're with around music artists and everything else and educate. They're not saying change the world, but just education is a huge part of everything. But
I do think that's one of the interesting things is when people hear, especially in music, they hear that I shoot competitively. Mm-hmm. I think it's not me coming at them going, man, you need to have like 10 guns in your car and you need to walk into, you know, you can't go in a store without one. Yeah. I come from a whole different place.
Right.
I'm like, I love this. And I talk about a lot, the people I shoot with. And they're like, I don't think they associate the gun with, oh my gosh, these are cool people. Like half these people. And that's, for me, it was a kind of a cool thing because there's not a lot of music industry people in the actual sport.
That's right.
But I've met more doctors, pilots, and people who are doing the craziest. My exposure has been very limited to you make music. That's what I do. That's what I see. So me being able to meet all these other people, that's the one thing I talk about, I think, the most is, let's call it just being an ambassador of the sport.
Yes.
And one of the cool things about, and I'll talk about this range for last thing, the amount, like, even though Gorka and I, whatever, we may be the big shooters here. We're not obviously the big shooters in this, actually. This. Right. I mean, look, we do well. But taking time to walk stages with somebody who's never done USPSA, that's the thing that we as a culture, people who have shot for a while, we need to really help people see the fun in it. Because even if that's not their main goal and they don't want to be competitive shooters like us, they come out and do 5 or 6 matches is better than 100 of you standing and shooting at some range at a target that's 5 feet away from you.
Right.
It's safer. You understand what a gun is and don't have that, I don't want to say fear, but you know, just understand what happens when your gun jams. What happens when you miss with the magazine? Like, these are things you don't do when you just stand and shoot and do that thing. So I encourage everybody. That's the first thing I say is come out and shoot action steel. You know, it's reactive. You hear it.
Right.
You don't have to worry about points or time. It's just literally come out and be safe. And man, I've seen so many people get into shooting because of that. So I think it's just as a group, we keep doing that. And, you know, obviously you keep doing what you're doing because
It's a team effort.
It's a team effort from like Masterpiece Arms guys.
Yeah.
I absolutely love what they're doing. In a market that is, you know, really the open market and the high-end gun market has gone stratospheric where it's not obtainable by most people.
Right.
And, you know, those guys are making a great quality product. They are around a lot. They're super nice guys. Like all those guys that are like they will just talk to you. And you know, look, things are expensive. We all know that.
Right.
But to have that entry level, really nice high end gun, I mean, we needed that as a sport. Really did.
Very,
so
very
I'm
cool.
glad to see those guys.
Cool. what's next for you? Just what, any goals you have or anything you're doing with the shooting sports, anything else?
I'm senior in IFSC. So coming up another year, I'm coming up on senior in USPSA.
Okay.
So it's been a long time goal. So I ended up getting fit from shooting 10 stages and, you know, sucking wind and being like, oh my gosh, I'm going to die and have my back surgery. So we are 5-6 days a week at the gym training for this specifically. And I'm in better shape than I've ever been. And I love the sport for that. It has really put me into the best shape of my life. Right. And so kind of had my eye on the having that 55, you know, internationally, USPSA, having a really great, you know, entry level into that senior thing. So I would love to, you know, do well at nationals as a senior. I would love to do, you know, hopefully Craig and I and one of my teammates were really pushing ourselves, not hard, but we're pushing ourselves. We'd love to, you know, be with, you know, Todd and Keith Garcia, hopefully on the senior team for World Shoot. So it's always in the back of the mind. You know, and I just really want to, you know, I shoot with some guys that are 75 and I want to be that person who's just, you know, shooting for the love of it and doing that. And it's been great. So
one last question, the music side, and we'll get off. One person that you could work with, one person that you haven't had the opportunity yet to be, past or present. Well, past would be like, I hear you. Who would you look up to, like, to want to work with once? Buddy comes to mind, or have you pretty much not really a pinnacle kind of thing for you like that? Because you said earlier your goals is number one, top of the chart, stuff like that. It's not individuals, so I didn't know if that might be something or not.
I'll be honest with you, probably not now, but I would have loved to have done probably Phil Collins stuff.
Okay.
Phil Collins Genesis.
Yeah.
And probably the all-time, which would scare me to death. And it's like one of those, like, so Phil Collins is like, I would work with him because I absolutely love what he does. Right. I mean, I don't care if, you know, people hate me for that, but it's like, you know, I think he's made great music. I love that. My all-time favorite is The Police.
Okay.
And
you ever met?
Yeah. Well, I know Stuart well.
Okay.
But Andy and Sting, I don't, but Stuart is absolutely a blast. 24. Like, he absolutely one of the coolest dudes, but them as a group scare me because they are one of the ones that, like, I used to listen to The Police records and be like, I was trying to play drums with Stuart. And it was like, you know, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is who I, so they're the untouchable.
Fair enough.
And so I would say I would be scared and wouldn't want to work with, but you know, they're cool. But Genesis Phil Collins thing is like, that was some great music.
So. Well, cool. Darren, thank you so much for sharing with me today. That was,
it was a long talk. So
I love it. And I hope our listeners are still listening, but if not, it was for me.
Yeah, anyway, edited down. It's all good.
No, I'm not editing. No, this is for me. Version. This is for me.
Oh, I'm sure we will.
You know, you have any questions for Darren, please let me know and email me at info@huntershdgold.com. And you can check out Darren at pretty much a lot of major matches going on, shooting BCC with Team Da Vinci, and does a great job representing them. So until next time, you know, thank you so much for watching or listening to this episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. We'll see you at the range. Thanks, Darren.
Absolutely.
For a complete written transcript of the Dr. Bill Show, go online to www.icarusmusic.com.
And welcome back to the Dr. Bill Show. Let's go to a caller who seems to be having issues communicating with his girlfriend. Caller?
Yeah, I had this problem with my girlfriend. She kind of broke up with me. I've been doing everything right. Everything's been going great. We went out. We've gone out for, I don't know, I'd say a good 5-6 months. Everything's good. I mean,
but son, you've gotta use communication.
I've done that. I mean, what else can I do? I mean, seriously, I mean, like,
Son, some girls are just bitches.